Oh, I have had no luck lately. Wait, lady luck?
Britsky, I got you. I've had so much luck on SpinQuest.com. They have all of my favorite games, slot games, live blackjack craps, and bubble craps. You can even get a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
10 bucks for 30? I'm headed over to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Comics Corner. I am your host, Connor, joined by my co-host, Harry.
Hello, bet you weren't expecting this.
We have indeed missed this show. We were just saying that we're sick to the back teeth of politics, and so we thought we'd actually...
I think everybody is at this point. So we thought we'd go back and, like we always did with this show, tear down some idols.
Yeah, well, we're mainly doing it because that was Alan Moore's express purpose with this work. It was to defile everything virtuous and heroic and aspirational, and to say that actually all of the costume heroes that you revere are weird degenerates, perverts, and liars. And the only person that is a hero, at least this is what you think, silly chud, is a raving homeless man who may not have won in the end, and if you like him, you're literally a fascist. That's right, we're talking about Watchmen!
Yes, finally. We certainly are. And I was saying right before we started recording this that I was surprised at this rewatch, because my views in this discussion are probably going to be the polar opposite of the views that I gave when I spoke about this with John Wheatley back in 2022, because this most recent reread and rewatch of the film really opened my eyes to, one, all of the subtextual things that were going on with this book, his true intentions with this book, and also just how hateful this book is, not only to the medium of comics and the characters, but to the audience itself, because in the same way that the Rorschach test is supposed to be what you see in it, this book is trying to reflect the audience's own desires for a simple, friendly, enjoyable, fun comic book story involving a cast of colorful characters. It is spitting that desire right back at them and hates them for having that desire in the first place, and thinks that you are a fascist for wanting to have simple costumed fun. And I think this may be a reflection of Alan Moore's own self-hatred for being a comic book writer in the first place, when clearly he has greater ideas of what he should be, a serious novelist of some kind, which he is trying to shift into now. But it was really shocking. And also on the mention of Wheatley, I had a fun little surprise, which is when I first covered this, Wheatley borrowed this exact copy off of me and used this as a bookmark, which I found in here, and is a nice little Wheatley jump scare that I received. That at whatever time this was, he was thinking about bringing in Thinking Fast and Slow, science fictions, and reminded himself which floor fours work best for holographic display applications.
How nostalgic.
God, I miss you, John.
So, I wanted to start off with a quote from Grant Morrison, the sort of wizard nemesis.
I think I might have a similar or the same quote, because I also looked into Grant Morrison's views on this.
Yeah, so it's quite famous that Grant Morrison and Alan Moore hate each other because one is battling to be the most pretentious comic book writer, and both believe in magic. And so, if they both believe that comic books are a medium for enforcing an interpretation upon the world that can then change how humans perceive things and basically change the structure of the world in these sort of hermeneutic practices, they want to claim the mantle of being able to do that best through DC Comics. And when Grant Morrison was asked for his opinions on Watchmen, he said the following: "I was the first person to say Watchmen wasn't very good. In fact, the only person ever to say that, and it made Alan so angry, so then I would get worse. I said that Watchmen was the 300-page equivalent of a sick-form poem. The fact that none of the characters were allowed to be smarter than the author, that really drove me nuts. The world's smartest man is an idiot. He makes a plan all his life that's undone at the end of the book in an instant. The psychiatrist sits with Rorschach for 5 minutes, and Rorschach tells a super banal story of how he became a vigilante, and the psychiatrist cracks. And if you're a criminal psychiatrist who deals with men in prison, you've heard a million of these stories. It was all to make a specific point about how the real world isn't like superhero comics." And I can't believe that I'm saying it, but Grant Morrison has said something really sensible for
us. Grant Morrison is absolutely right. I do have a similar yet different quote from him, which was that if you strip away the cleverness of the of parts of the plot and some of the character stuff, all you're left with is a deeply cynical story written by a man overly invested in deconstructing the sex lives of fictional cartoon characters.
Oh, Banger. Right, okay. This is why this episode is titled Why Watchmen Ruined Comics, because Watchmen was so successful, the comics industry has become a victim of Watchmen's success. Watchmen is one of the reliable, best-selling graphic novels every year since its publication in 1986 and 7, and ever since, it has set the tone for what superhero comics think superhero comics should be. The industry is now in a permanent state of deconstruction. There is no higher heroic ideal that any hero can aspire to without being knocked down a peg by the writer that wants to make their mark on a given book. And as in Watchmen, all of the heroes are sexual reprobates, racists, compromised by working for the government, doing
pathetic,
shady deals.
Just pathetic and cowardly by themselves.
Yeah, they're cuckolds, they're impotent unless they wear their costume, and everything is some sort of grand psychological projection about their own inadequacies, and society itself is indicted for letting these weird freaks and reprobates play out their sexual and power fantasies and call it heroism. There is no for you to be an actual hero. Everything is to be regarded with suspicion.
And that's why I noted when I first started reading this back again, and I messaged you and said, you know, like, Alan Moore is completely obsessed with sex, and it filters through every single page of the comic book. And one of the interesting things is Zack Snyder, save for one or two lines, which are considered quite iconic to the comic from some of the iconic scenes, really does not dwell in the psychosexual aspects of the story in the same way that Moore does. What I said before we started was that this book is the Frankfurt School theory of authoritarian personality put into comic book form. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, Moore himself, as we know, is a form of Marxist. But when I was listening to interviews with him before we, in preparation for this, I noted that he was trying to put a Freudian Marxist spin on this. Now, what were the Frankfurt School? The Frankfurt School were a mix of Freudian psychoanalysis and sexual ideas with the old school Marxists trying to come to a synthesis between the two and come up with ways through which they can analyze society that way. I noticed this when Alan Moore said that he had been thinking, and this was what led to him writing The Lost Girls, that he'd been thinking about Peter Pan, and then been thinking about how Peter Pan can fly, and literary allusions, flying typically means freedom in some way. And then he tried to put a Freudian spin on it and thought, well, maybe in that case, actually, given that he's a stunted boy in arrested development who never wants to grow up, perhaps flying can represent a kind of sexual freedom. And so he decided, why don't I try and write a story about a sexualized Peter Pan? At which point my first thought was, why would that ever cross your mind? He is a child. He is a child who refuses to grow up, and you want to sexualize him? Very strange. And it was because that didn't work that he ended up going, well, what if I got Wendy from Peter Pan and then teamed her up with Dorothy and Alice and made their sexual adventures? But it was interesting. And in that as well, he mentioned that he, in doing research for all this, had read through an unnamed book that he said was a sexual analysis and history of the Great War, because Lost Girls is set around the time of the Great War. Now, in research for my Weimar Republic video, which is not yet out, I know exactly which book he is referring to. It is The Sexual History of the Great War by Magnus Hirschfeld.
Oh, that Magnus Hirschfeld.
Yes, that Magnus Hirschfeld. So he is overtly referring to Freud and Magnus Hirschfeld for inspiration in his work, which results in this kind of Frankfurt School theory put into comics, because the Frankfurt School's theory was that through a mixture of sexual repression and maladaptive childhoods where children have been subject to overtly authoritarian parenting leads to children idolizing authority and developing maladaptive sexual repression. It's always about sexual repression, that they end up idolizing authority and becoming fascists. That was their theory of the authoritarian personality and fascism, which is just this comic book.
And the solution to this, of course, in post-war Germany was to give a bunch of war orphans to known paedophiles, because that, of course, won't result in all sorts of atrocities that would then produce a massive political backlash. I hadn't thought about that, but you're right.
Which might suggest why the one character who is overtly shown to hate sexual degeneracy and actively murders a child abuser who potentially sexually abused and then murdered a little girl.
It certainly is implied, especially in the Snyder adaptation where
he finds
her underwear in the incinerator.
Yes, it's heavily implied that she was sexually abused as well before being murdered. Alan Moore sees him as the ultimate evil of the story.
He tries to have... When Rorschach in the comic book confronts Adrian Veidt on the rainy night, which is replaced by a scene in the middle of the day with Dan Dreiberg actually going to speak to Veidt in the film. When Rorschach goes to confront Veidt about the death of the comedian and warn him that someone's killing superheroes, Veidt says that Blake is basically a Nazi. And I remember Rorschach actually...
And what does he wear as his costume in the comics? A gimp mask.
Yes, and the American flag.
And the American flag, which again, Snyder changes... Because unlike Alan Moore, he is not completely goon-brained.
Yes. And he also doesn't think that sexual violence, for example, as caused by repression in the comedian attempting to, you know, rape Silt Spectre 1, then translates into political authoritarianism. It just doesn't translate one-to-one. But it was quite interesting because Moore puts these words in Rorschach's mouth, and obviously he thinks that Rorschach is beneath contempt because he's based on The Question and Mr. A, characters created by Steve Ditko, co-creator of Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. Steve Ditko is an objectivist. There's actually a comic in Denny O'Neill's revived run of The Question after post-crisis because O'Neill decided he hated objectivism because he was basically a hippie. Great Batman editor, not great on politics. And he decided... To mock The Question, mock Rorschach by having The Question read Watchmen and then dress up as Rorschach for an issue. And then he basically fumbles and gets beaten up and tied to a tree, and the guy's trying to beat him up and go, any last words? And he goes, yeah, being Rorschach sucks. So they're trying to constantly pour scorn on the politics that are associated with Rorschach, even though he's the hero. So when Veidt calls the comedian practically a Nazi, Rorschach says he stood up for his country, he never let anybody retire him, never cashed in on his reputation, never set up a company selling posters and diet books and toy soldiers based on himself, never became a prostitute. If that makes him a Nazi, you might as well call me a Nazi too. And of course, that's Alan Moore saying that if you put forward, you know, sexually repressive standards, or you disapprove of welfare queens and prostitutes and communists, as Rorschach does in his opening monologue, then you are basically a fascist. But Moore doesn't realize, and this is why Watchmen is a accidentally celebrated work and made such a good film. Mm-hmm. Moore doesn't realize that the narrative, framing Rorschach as the sole narrator, ending with Rorschach, you know, telling the truth and outing Veidt's scheme, refusing to compromise, even in the face of Armageddon at both beginning and end, and taking obviously correct actions like, you know, killing the unrepentant child murderer. He doesn't realize that he actually sets Rorschach up to be the hero and inadvertently makes all the right-wing politics legitimate and all of the utopian-minded murderous utilitarianism associated with Veidt equally as impotent and horrible.
See, the problem is with Moore is that for all of his lofty literary pretensions, there's still that version of him that was enticed enough by superhero comics when he was younger to still have ironically enough, when we're talking about childish repression and nostalgia and such, to still have a holdover where when you see videos of him reading through the narration, and how he reads through the Rorschach journals and puts on a gritty voice for them and takes them with a really solemn seriousness. You can tell that one of the things that led to this confusion is he still wanted Rorschach to be cool.
Yeah.
There was still a part of him that was, and I feel a great conflicted twisting and turning throughout the pages of this book, because Moore still can't help himself throughout it. And this is why I think as well, one of the reasons it's so celebrated is that in the 3.5 issues worth of actual story that you get from the comic, that isn't just one-off issues dedicated to the character's backstory or random side characters who die at the end anyway, who I would say it would be frankly, quite charitable to even call them two-dimensional. When it's not dedicating time to that, Alan Moore is writing a cool mystery investigation story with superheroes who do cool things. Rorschach can think on his feet fast enough that he's able to almost get himself out of a police raid when he's backed into a corner. Dan and Silk Spectre do still go out of their way to go and help people in this big floating spaceship that can fire blasts. And there is this part of him that's still like, this is still cool. And I still want these characters to be cool, which is helped by some of Dave Gibbons' artwork. But at the same time, he still has this ultimate goal guiding everything that he does, that he has to subvert everything cool. So it's like he's at war with himself.
He's almost like trying to say, yes, it's even worse that you like this because I'm presenting the most engaging, visually stunning version of the thing that you love and still calling you a fascist and childish for enjoying it. There was an interview a couple of years ago that he gave to The Guardian, and he said he was worried actually that people were watching superhero movies, because the last one he watched was apparently Batman 89, and he's been on a strike ever since. He hasn't even seen the Snyder adaptation. He was worried that people were still watching these films because he saw them as juvenile, because of course he sees that there are no values being transmitted in it. There are no aspirational, heroic ideals that are being conveyed. Everything is actually just...
Unlike in Lost Girls.
Exactly. Everything is just a cover for your own perversions and power fantasies and sick and twisted politics. And so he is horrified that people are still watching superhero movies into their 20s, that they haven't grown out of it. And he sees this as walking down the path to fascism, which would then explain how you got the Frankfurt School interpretation from.
Again, as we get further into the discussion, the topic of nostalgia permeates this entire thing, because it's an indictment on nostalgia itself, or the idea of an idealized past. And the reason for this is, again, academics have come to the conclusion that one of the hallmarks of fascism is a yearning back to an idealized or imagined past. And so Alan Moore sees the kind of idealized America of Captain America in those original comic books, or even Batman helping out the American war effort in the 1940s. He sees that kind of idealized vision of the past as it existed in the 1980s as another stepping stone to fascism.
Well, that explains why anytime you get one of those edits of how Britain was in the 50s, 60s, or 70s crossing your timeline, it's immediately associated with fascism. Or there's that sort of Reddit trope of no one was ever happy, nobody ever had families, nobody ever had a white picket fence, the dad was always abusing the mum, the son was always secretly gay, the girl was always lobotomized, nobody has ever had a normal family life ever, you just have to accept the current miserable conditions that we have forced you to live in.
Well, if you wonder how that mindset managed to permeate so much of the culture that people will just throw that out offhand without even thinking about it, it is because of the pop culture that people have been consuming since probably the 1960s at least, that has all been influenced by people like the Frankfurt School theorists. And that's because Watchmen is presenting you an engaging and thrilling mystery story with this colorful cast of interesting and compelling characters on the surface, but the subtext, all of this stuff that people may not understand the first time that they go reading through, like why in the issue when Dr. Manhattan and Silk Spectre are on Mars is there repeated flash forwards to the nostalgia bottle flipping around and around and around before eventually smashing to lead to the emotional culmination of the issue. Why are there all of these things where nostalgia as a perfume is brought up? Why, when Silk Spectre and Dan embrace one another in the final part of the story, after Veidt has already succeeded in his mission, do they bring attention to the fact that Dan is wearing nostalgia perfume? Why do they bring attention to the fact that Rorschach was wearing nostalgia aftershave when he was arrested? Well, it's because in the back of your head, you are drawing negative associations with the idea of nostalgia. Nostalgia is a false past. Nostalgia is authoritarianism. Nostalgia is retreat into sexual perversion and fantasy to escape the reality of right now and today. That may have been influenced by the Cold War era in which Moore was writing this, but that kind of attitude does leak, Red Letter Media style, your brain recognizes it, into your mind, and then you project that thought out into the world around you. Hollywood's been doing it for years. They always associate authoritarian, fascist, neo-Nazi characters as being secret, repressed homosexuals. They do it in American Beauty, where the neo-Nazi next-door neighbor appears crying at the end of the film out of nowhere and kisses the main character on the lips before leaving the rest of the film and you don't see him again.
Same with American History X. The neo-Nazi gang decides to prison rape Edward Norton's character.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the black guy takes him in as a friend.
Yeah, why do they do all of this? Well, because they're implanting these ideas in your mind. And that is what this is doing. This is one of the most popular comic books ever written. If you're telling me it didn't have an effect on culture, then you're just wrong.
Yeah, this is one of the most influential text of the 20th century, I would say. And it was essentially poisoning the well of what America were using at the time to as a product to export as part of their cultural hegemony. Because as you said, Batman, Superman, the Marvel superheroes, they ones that existed at the time, fought in the Second World War. They were part of the war effort. And then when you have Iron Man coming along, he's fighting in the Vietnam War. You have superheroes after this involving themselves in the War on Terror. There are superhero comics will map onto the political circumstances at the time. The year that Watchmen was published, and I think we should get into some of the biographical and
Absolutely.
And other such information because it might provide some background. But the year Watchmen was published, Crisis on Infinite Earths had just finished. Go see our episode on that and Legends for more. Yep. Superman was a presidential ally of Ronald Reagan. He was an establishment figure. The Justice League had official UN sanctioning, or they were endorsed by the UN, rather. So superheroes were aligned with America as the unquestionable moral force in the Cold War, and they were projecting American hegemony as the righteous power against the evil empire out across the world. At the same time, Alan Moore is saying, actually, our superheroes are kind of morally bankrupt, and we ourselves are no better than those that we would cast scorn upon, and it's actually just authority itself that's the problem. So Moore and Gibbons were brought over to DC as part of the British invasion. They both started on 2000 AD. Moore had originally submitted a Judge Dredd pitch, and Alan Grant, who was editing 2000 AD at the time, Alan Grant, later the celebrated Batman writer who helped out with Nightfall, and I think he produced the comic book Shadow of the Bat, if I remember correctly. He asked him to write...
I got that at home somewhere.
It was a good series. It was a psychological study of Batman's villains.
Yeah, my dad has handed over to me just a load of his old comics from the 80s that he had, which is why I've got one of the first printings of Killing Joke that I brought in that time.
Oh, yeah, there you go. I always did wonder as well if there was enmity between Alan Moore and Grant Morrison, because Grant Morrison wanted Brian Boland to draw Serious House and Serious Earth, and instead Alan Moore got the Brian Boland art on Killing Joke instead.
That would have been... Imagine if those had been flipped. That would have been interesting, because I don't think that... what's his name? The painter from
Dave McKean?
Yeah, I don't think Dave McKean would fit very well with the kind of very regimented grid panels that Alan Moore loves using in his comic books.
Yes. Dave Gibbons actually drew for the first issue of 2000 AD and contributed to 108 of the first 131 issues and then left to go be artist on Doctor Who magazine. Moore, at the time, was then publishing V for Vendetta in Warrior, and his work came to the attention of Swamp Thing creator Len Wein, who then hired Moore to revolutionize Swamp Thing in 1983. And it's significant because Len Wein was the editor for some of Watchmen. And then about issue 5, when issue 5 was being published and Alan Moore had given in the script treatment for the last issues, Len Wein quit the book.
Yeah, I bet he did.
And the reason was Len Wein recognized that the ending had been plagiarized from an episode of The Outer Limits.
Oh, really?
Where a series of scientists fabricate an alien invasion to try to end the Cold War. And in the episode of The Outer Limits, one scientist...
I had no idea about this, because one of the things that I was going to praise him for was that the mystery is interesting, and that Moore had managed to write a smartest character in the world who, at least on first glance, did actually feel like an intelligent character. So the fact that you just nicked it, that's amazing.
Yeah, so it was the episode was called The Architects of Fear, and essentially a group of scientists get together and they do cosmetic surgery on one of the scientists to turn him into an alien, and he gets fatally shot, and the plan goes wrong, and his wife finds his body and she weeps. Alan Moore decided to take that and possibly the plot of Ursula Le Guin's Lave of Heaven, where the main character is called George Orr, it's an homage to George Orwell.
Yeah.
He has a superpower he can't control, which is that he dreams things and they come true. And there's a psychiatrist who's trying to manipulate him to try and make the world perfect. And at one point, the world is at war, and the psychiatrist goes, right, dream of an alien invasion to stop the world going to war. And George dreams up an alien invasion to bring all of Earth together. There's an iconic bit where the aliens are spotted on the moon. He goes, get rid of the aliens from the moon. And then suddenly all the glass explodes outside. He goes, what the hell's happened? He goes, they're not on the moon anymore because they've landed. It's such a great book. But Ween...
Okay, I need to give that a read. That sounds good.
Oh, it's fantastic. Yeah. Ween recognized that Moore had plagiarized The Outer Limits, and Moore confessed it to him, though Moore currently denies it to this day. And Ween said, look, you need to rewrite the ending, otherwise we've got no integrity. Moore refused, so Ween quit.
You know, this... like we'll mention later, improves the ending of the film version even more to me in that case. But that's fascinating, at least in those, like you say, with the Outer Limits, it goes wrong. And at least in the
Ursula Le Guin.
Ursula Le Guin book, it's a series of escalating events where the things actually are happening. Because frankly, if you put a bit of critical thought and scrutiny to the plot, to the plan at the end of this, it does begin to fall apart just a little bit. But no, I would have thought that Len Wein might have quit because he realized that, hold up, this comic hates the industry that it's part of and everything that I've been working for my entire career. Never mind, because in some of the interviews that I watched with Moore, he was saying that it was only around issue 3 that he realized what he was writing, and that at first his initial intention was to write a just slightly cleverer than most superhero comic mystery story limited series, and it was only in issue 3, and he said the editors had been really, really happy with the third issue, and then it was receiving the fourth issue, Dr. Manhattan's backstory issue, that they all started to get a bit of cold feet around it. So I wonder if Len Wein was also thinking like, and now he's dedicating an entire issue to this one guy where the plot doesn't move forward at all, and then just got a bit sick of him.
To be fair, I don't think Wein would have been worried about that particular bit, because obviously he allowed Moore to change Swamp Thing, and most of Moore's Swamp Thing follows the similar tone of the Dr. Manhattan issue. It's a sort of exploration of existential and body horror, and it's the relationship between a man and a plant. There's not a whole lot of punching going on, but I think that Len Wein, just God rest his soul, had a lot of creative integrity, and so
you know what, respect and fair to him that he refused to stand by while an act of just like massive plagiarism was going on underneath him.
Yeah, so Wein also hired Gibbons in for DC, and he brought Gibbons over to do, I think it was Green Lantern Corps, first of all. Yep, starting from issue 161, he was doing the backup issues in Green Lantern of the Tales of the Green Lantern Corps. And both Moore and Gibbons would work on that series. They eventually worked together on the issue Mogo Doesn't Socialize, where they created the living planet that then Geoff Johns would then incorporate into his Green Lantern run in 2005. Yeah. And there's a hilarious line where Alan Moore was interviewed in, I think it was 2008 or 2009, during the Blackest Night saga of Green Lantern. And they said, oh, what do you think about Green Lantern now that it's undergoing a transformation? It's using some of your ideas and Dave's ideas from the Green Lantern Corps annuals. What do you think that Geoff Johns is finally making good on the mythology that you did? And he said, I feel like raccoons are going through my trash. Which, to be fair to Geoff Johns, in the 90s to 2000s, was trying to reverse the Alan Moore-ification of the industry with JSA.
You can tell with like his stories tend to have such a more colorful and upbeat vibe to them.
Yeah, they're Silver Age coded. And Infinite Crisis is undoing Crisis on Infinite Earths to a large extent. It's bringing back the multiverse. It's giving the Golden Age Superman a happy ending. It's rebuilding heroes from when they've been torn down by identity crisis, Wonder Woman killing Maxwell Lord, Superman undergoing an existential crisis, thinking, should I even be Superman anymore? It's bringing those people back. And then now Geoff Johns, unfortunately, has been ensnared by the industry itself, where he's just writing Alan Moore tribute acts with three Jokers and Doomsday Clock.
Mm.
Geoff Johns ended up doing the sequel to Watchmen, which then famously was delayed and woefully performed. And nobody asked for three Jokers, retconning the Killing Joke either. So it seems that Alan Moore has had a noxious effect on the comics industry, where even those who, in the sort of Nietzschean phrase, those who try to fight monsters spend so long fighting Alan Moore's monster that they become Alan Moore themselves. It's also quite ironic as well, because the kind of the characters that Alan Moore says that Geoff Johns stole from him were actually invented by Wein, Marv Wolfman, and Mike W. Barr in 1981.
If you would like to see the full version of this premium video, please head over to lotuseaters.com and subscribe to gain full access to all of our premium content.
What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here, and you know what's more American than America's 250th birthday?
supporting American-owned companies like SpinQuest, America's number one social casino with over 1,000 games like Live Dealer Blackjack and Craps. They're offering new users a $30 coin package for just $10. Go to SpinQuest.com and sign up today.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.